Choices here are broken. As children grow, they grow with what they see. And in these times where paranoia closes in, power and hate are rampaging disease. In our minds we build the blocks to what we need. In our minds we're reaching out for peace. In our hearts we know of such the hills to climb. In our hearts a sense of master feed.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Catherine Newman, who is the Dean of the School of the Arts and Sciences and Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. She's the author of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings, and has an article at CNN in School Shootings, Patterns and Warning Signs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Catherine Newman.
Thank you so much.
And in your article, Catherine, you mentioned talking about the kind of symmetry here, if you will, with these young disturbed boys and young men who conduct these mass shootings at schools, the latest of whom, of course, is Adam Lanza. You're saying that though they're often intelligent, high-performing boys, their peers tend to see them as unattractive losers, weak and unmanly. Isn't that a part of our problem here? Here I am talking to you from Hollywood. Across the street from the studio is Universal Studios. In our culture, don't we associate guns with manliness and heroism?
Sadly, we do in popular culture. In real life, of course, it's not really what we see. And so in the communities where these boys are growing up, they see men who are, you know, truck drivers and lawyers and doctors and teachers. That's what real men look like. But in popular culture, I think it's true that we tend to see an association between violence and manliness. And unfortunately, popular culture is what is most powerful in projecting images to teenagers. And that is what these boys tend to rivet on. And it does drive them toward events and actions that they think will gain them the attention they want and the persona, more to the point, that they desperately desire, which is an improvement over the persona everyone sees in them.
Well, you did research after a number of these shootings. I think it was the Paducah, Kentucky shooting. Was it the boy there who thought that by shooting these kids, he'd become more popular?
Yes. When he was asked what he thought was going to happen when the shooting was over, he said, well, I thought they would come to my house and I would go to their house and I would be cool and I would have friends. And sadly, friends is what he really wanted. And unfortunately, this was the method he thought would gather him those friends. And it sounds almost bizarre that that's the case, but he had had many episodes of other attempts to gain attention, all of which failed. And when he started talking about shooting people, all of a sudden, the groups he was trying to ingratiate himself with started to pay attention. So sadly, what we discover is that these attention-getting comments work. And because they work, they create commitments that young boys are making in a rather public way. And for them to default on those promises to shoot people looks like one more social failure. They can't back away from it.
So when you have these shooters like Adam Lanza, and I suppose the shooter in Colorado didn't want to go out in a blaze of glory, but I think the one at Virginia Tech, and I just spoke yesterday with the survivor of Virginia Tech, who still has three of the four bullets in his body. He was one of seven survivors out of a class of 17. I believe that shooter killed himself, and clearly Adam Lanza did. And you mentioned in your article, Catherine Newman, the in school shootings, patterns and warning signs. And of course, you've researched this subject for your book, Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shooting. The notion that, quoting you, many of these young men are trying to cast themselves as stars of a movie that ends in a blaze of suicidal gunfire and notoriety.
That's exactly the point. They think of that as a more appealing public image than the public image they have, which is one of socially awkward, frictional relations with other people, they're looking for an alternative, and the alternative that popular culture shows them is this blazing gunman, and frequently they will dress in trench coats because they think that looks cool, and that's what the social imagery is showing them. And so, unfortunately, what they're seeking is a way to change the way their peers see them, and sadly, none of their other efforts bear fruit. But this dramatic anti-hero action does bear fruit, and it does long before they do the shooting. People do start paying attention. In fact, we have evidence of other kids egging them on. When Michael Carneal, one of the shooters we studied in Kentucky, stole a gun and came to school, the goth group that he was desperate to impress said, "Oh, no, we don't like that gun. We want you to bring a shotgun." So Michael turned around and brought a shotgun and shot three kids with it. So he was a very vulnerable, impressionable young man who was desperate to get the approval of these older boys who seemed cool to him. And this was the method, and the only method that actually worked, because all of his earlier pranks, stealing CDs, telling loud jokes, sticking gum in girls' hair, none of that worked. That just further labeled him as an out-of-touch dweeb.
So it isn't the real problem here, though, that our law enforcement in the United States is hamstrung, as is no other law enforcement organization in the advanced industrial world, like we are, because of the lobbying efforts of the NRA that have all but neutered the ATF, the agency that's supposed to monitor firearms, the Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives Agency. And one of the things the NRA succeeded in doing is preventing any law enforcement from sharing data on those that are mentally ill or have a history thereof and those who purchase guns. So I'm not sure that the psychological background and motivations of these children are as important as the fact that as a society, there's no way to know there's no tracking in terms of their mental illness and those that buy guns. And isn't that where we should be focusing our efforts on simply preventing people with a history of mental illness from being able to purchase firearms or get their hands on firearms?
I think there's a great deal that we could do from a policy point of view to address issues like the one you've just raised. And I certainly concur with you that it's a form of social madness to permit people who are so disturbed from getting their hands on guns. I think the NRA has an awful lot to answer for, and perhaps they finally will have to answer, because one feels a certain seismic shift in the country today, and let's hope that that persists long enough to actually do something. But I have to offer a slight caution here, and that is that what gun control and these kinds of measures will do is to make it much more difficult for the ambivalent would-be shooter to get his hands on a gun and do damage. And there are many more people who are ambivalent about these actions than there are people who are completely committed and I think largely unstoppable from a gun control point of view. So we need gun control. We need the measures you've talked about to stop the sort of mildly committed. But someone who is really determined to get their hands on guns will find a way, even in societies that have extraordinary gun control. And for that, we need additional remedies. We need to encourage people who hear threats to come forward. We need to be sure that those threats are taken seriously. We need to address the mental health, the vast reservoir of mental health needs that are going untreated. We need to educate our young people that bullying or social ostracism can have extraordinary costs and that they need to be more reflective about the damage they may be doing. It's part of the peer experience. We can all remember what teenage life was like. Very few of us in adulthood want to go back to it because it's not an easy time of life, and these forms of ostracism are very painful. And we need our children to understand that that can be extremely dangerous and damaging. So I would argue that the gun control and other policy remedies you've mentioned are extremely important. They are necessary conditions, but they will not by themselves address the issues involved in a totally dedicated, determined shooter. And for that, we need a much more comprehensive strategy, of which this is just a part.
But Catherine Newman, then what about the broader issue of social responsibility in the sense that our media, movies and television, you can't basically go by a movie poster without seeing a gun pointed at you, or watch a TV show without people pointing and shooting guns. And, for example, in the culture where I grew up, Australia, sometimes in a macho culture, people settle their issues with fists. But if anybody introduced a gun or a knife, they would be considered abject cowards. And we live in a culture where guns are not instruments of cowardice. They are the means by which problems are solved and people become heroes. So why not change that cultural vector? Why not make guns instruments of shame and cowardice as opposed to problem solvers and heroic instruments?
Well, I'm completely with you on this. I have no objection to that idea at all, and I think you might want to talk to the people across the street who are, in many ways, the creators of the popular culture images that are so influential in our society, because up until now, anyway, they've sort of gone the other direction, and that is regrettable, and it has consequences. And I think we all, as you say, do need to examine for ourselves why we find those images so appealing. And it would be helpful if we didn't, and if we turned them off and made them commercially unsuccessful. I mean, sadly, they are commercially very successful, and it would be better if they weren't. So I don't disagree with you about the critique you're offering. I think they play a powerful role in a very negative set of motivations that very marginal boys feel rather strongly. Now, there are other things that I think are consistent with this that we should pay attention to. In big cities, boys who have different interests, interested in, I don't know, chess or dance or classics or whatever, they can find a niche, and they do. The problem for the marginal boy who's in a small rural town is that there are very few alternatives that are socially satisfying. Most of these boys who become shooters are very high functioning. They're smart. They're often very interested in academic subjects, and they don't get a lot of social reinforcement for that. If they're not also good at football, their social options are very limited. And we should be asking ourselves about that too, because our definitions of masculinity that begin to fall into place when young boys are, 13, 14 years old, are extremely limiting if you're not fortunate enough to be in a big city like Los Angeles or New York, where there are many options to find a niche. There are not so many options in places like Jonesboro, Arkansas, or probably in this small town in Connecticut, because small towns tend not to be quite as diverse in representations of masculinity. And it matters. It really matters. The reason these boys feel so marginal is that they are mentally ill, and that sets them off on a path, and then it's exacerbated by finding so little social support for the things that do interest them. And now if we take them away and just look at the kids who aren't going to shoot anybody but are actually some of the most upstanding sort of citizens of those high schools, we found that the strong students complained to us that nobody ever holds a parade for the winners of the academic marathon or college bowl. They hold a parade only for the kids who are good at sports. Well, why is that? And it, not only what the school does, why do the rest of us attend celebrations of, sports teams, but we don't attend or even throw celebrations for, the kid who wins the math Olympiad? We really need to examine the whole range of ways in which we validate what it means to be a successful young man or a successful young woman and find more diverse opportunities for people to be honored.
Well, just in closing, though, Catherine Newman, you mentioned having a parade. But in this society and in our culture of late, particularly in our politics, the very profession of teachers has been denigrated, and they've been downsized, and their unions have been defunded. And I think in many ways that it's pretty clear to me, at least, that the teachers involved in this school in Connecticut, the six who died, they died protecting young children. They died like soldiers in war. They took bullets to protect children, and they're heroes. I mean, so do you think as a society we're going to start valuing teachers more and stop denigrating them?
Well, I wish we would. I think your point is extremely well taken. We never give teachers the credit that they deserve. And I must tell you that some of the saddest interviews that we did in connection with the book Rampage were of teachers who had served in schools that had been traumatized in this way. And they found that people were very impatient with them. They expected them to be mental health treatment officials when they had no background. They were math teachers or social studies teachers. Their insurance policies did not cover them for the mental health needs they had in the aftermath of these bloodbaths. So not only did we not particularly value them when they were doing their normal jobs, when they were on the receiving end of this horrible violence, we weren't providing proper health care for them. We were expecting them to come back to work within a week or two and take care of everybody else. Meanwhile, you know, some of them had been shot at. And so I think, in general, we don't think enough about who they are, what they contribute, and how they need to be cared for. I think you will find that the teachers in this school in Newton, Connecticut, are going to be themselves just as shaken up as any of the parents or the surviving children, and they're going to need to be cared for. And I hope we will have learned some lessons from earlier shootings and step up. But there wasn't much evidence of that in the schools that I looked at. And in the one in Arkansas, half the teachers left the profession within 3 years. They were so disturbed. So I'm sorry to say that the kind of fluorescence of solidarity that you see now in this traumatized town doesn't carry people all the way through to where they need to get to recover. That is a very long-term proposition.
Well, Catherine Newman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Catherine Newman, who's the Dean of the School of Arts and Sciences and Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. She's the author of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings, and she has an article at CNN in School Shootings, Patterns, and Warning Signs. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll answer your questions as best I can. The conversation continues at facebook.com/IanMastersMedia, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.